Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Lechner. Your expertise on the subject of carpal tunnel diagnosis and management is something that we hope to learn from today.
Well, thank you, Caroline. It's Caroline, correct?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, it's good to be here. And I've been in Asheville for 30 years this year, and it's been a pleasure to serve people here and be a hand specialist. So I'm glad to share some information with people that are interested.
Well, great. Well, as you may know, a lot of our ACO's membership are primary care providers. So this could be anywhere from, you know, pediatricians all the way up to geriatricians and people taking care of pregnant folks. So from a primary care perspective, I'd love to just hear what you would want a basic, a primary care provider to know about the basics of carpal tunnel syndrome diagnosis.
Sure. First of all, I think carpal tunnel is one of the things that patients kind of quietly hide and don't talk about a lot of times in their office visits. I know I've lived with it and just pretended it wasn't there. So I think it's something that does take a little probing to get patients to talk about sometimes. But let me just briefly define carpal tunnel syndrome. The nerves come out of the neck and go down the arm into the hand, of course, and there's several points of concern where the nerves are constricted. One, of course, is in the neck. And then for the median nerve, the next most important is the carpal tunnel itself, which is a very tight tunnel made up of bones on the back and a thick ligament on the front. And inside of that are 9 tendons, the 4 flexors to the fingers and 1 to the thumb, and then the median nerve itself, which supplies the feeling to your thumb, index, middle, and half of your ring finger, and also 1 branch to the muscles to your thumb. So it's really the critical nerve for function of the hand, and it's unfortunately placed inside of a very tight, rigid tube. And so anything that causes pressure on that nerve, and we can talk about the many causes as we go on, will cause symptoms of numbness, burning, pain, and misery, often waking the patient up at night.
And is there a particular population that we should be probing for these symptoms that you see most commonly?
Well, it's much more common in women than men, anywhere from 5 to 10 times more common in women, and that is most likely due to estrogen and hormonal changes in women. And of course, pregnant women particularly, it's not uncommon. Sometimes as high as half the pregnant patients will have symptoms of carpal tunnel during their pregnancy. So women is one particular group. It does become more common as patients turn 40, as many of the orthopedic problems become more common at that age. And all the way through 40 to 60 is kind of the first wave of carpal tunnel. And then there's another wave later in life in the 70s and 80s. So that's the main population. We don't see it very often in children. I think in 30 years I've treated maybe a half a dozen kids with carpal tunnel. And most of the time that turns out to be something related to rheumatoid arthritis or some other cause.
Okay. And what would be some of the more, you know, what are some of the mainstays of conservative management if we've got a, you know, a patient in this population starting to seek care for this?
But as I said, a lot of times, I think in the very early stages, patients won't talk about it. And if they were asked, do you ever get any tingling in the fingers, they might say yes, because it comes on very, very slowly. And one of the things I want to get through in the podcast is this isn't really a disease in the classic sense that you kind of get it and you're going to have it until it's fixed. You know, it's more of a spectrum of irritation of a nerve. And so in the very early stages, you may only get a couple episodes of tingling and a couple fingers, and then that can progress. So if the patient is beginning to talk about some tingling in the fingertips, but it isn't constant, that's really the window of opportunity for the non-specialists, the primary care providers, to really step in. Because a lot of those cases can be reversed quite easily, I think, with some stretching. Yoga is very helpful. To me, yoga is the most beneficial thing I've done for myself to help me keeping away from surgery on my carpal tunnel. Simple things like cat-cow, where you're on all fours and you're stretching your neck and back, and it also very gently stretches the fingers, and that's very helpful. Instructing the patients to avoid a lot of repetition, if they're working in the garden, to take breaks from using the shears or the vibrating tools, the chainsaws, the weed eaters, and take breaks and then put some ice packs on their wrists. This is really the most common sense way to prevent a more permanent problem.
That's interesting to me that, you know, I really think of this as like an overuse type of injury. So it's interesting to me that that you're recommending exercise and stretching and yoga as a potential treatment option. But I guess the key is that it's on the early side. Is that right?
Well, I'm not really recommending exercise like squeezing a tennis ball. That is not helpful. And hand grippers, I get a lot of folks that are older that want to overcome their carpal tunnel by strengthening the hand. Mm. And that really does make it worse. So that's a good point you're making. I'm talking more about stretching than exercising, you know, where you're putting the tendons under a gentle stretch and not, you know, grabbing a ball and squeezing it 30 times, 3 times a day. That is not helpful.
And is there any, so you mentioned the cat-cow, is there any particular physical therapist or physical therapy program that that could guide people on this more gentle stretching type plan?
Yeah, I think what I do with my patients, you know, I'm much more attuned to this now that I'm, you know, in my 60s, I'm more attuned to it because if I don't do these things, I'm kind of miserable through the day. So it's very natural to share with my patients some of the things I've learned. But just getting up in the morning and spending 10 minutes, it doesn't have to be yoga. It can be Pilates. It can be any kind of gentle stretch. And the therapists are very good at going over that with the patients. They do these tendon glide movements. And so I would definitely recommend one of the two. Generally, if a patient kind of lights up when I mention yoga or Pilates and they want to do it on their own, I will let them pursue it. If they look like they've never done that and never will, I often will send them to an occupational or a hand therapist or a physical therapist.
Great, great. Along the lines of that physical diagnosis that that a primary care doctor might do, you know, I think traditionally, we think of Tenell's and Phelan's tests. Are those sensitive or specific to this syndrome, or what should we be doing in the office in terms of physical diagnosis?
That's a good question. The history is the most important. You know, if a patient tells you that they're waking up at night and their thumb, index, middle, and half of their ring finger is going to sleep, That's more important than even the Tenell's and Phelan sign, in my opinion, in terms of making that diagnosis. That is the history of carpal tunnel, as opposed to cervical radiculopathy, which would be more during the day and activity related and, you know, moving the arms forward or whatever. So if it's nighttime numbness and it's in the anatomic distribution of the median nerve, you're going to really hone in on that, of course. Tenell's and Phelan signs are very specific. I'm very sensitive, but not very specific. There can be other things that can cause a positive finding. And I find the Tenell's sign is very confusing to some patients. They don't know what they're supposed to say. Sometimes the doctor doesn't really know what they're expecting from the patient either. Phelan's test is a little better, in my opinion, but you have to be patient and wait the full minute and see if they get the numbness with that test. But they're still very important. I kind of group those, all three of those, as the sort of the first tier of history and physical.
Okay, great. And then you mentioned estrogen and sort of women in their 40s and pregnant women as being one of the contributing factors. What other disease processes, if some of our patients have certain comorbidities, should we be, really asking these questions on our review of systems or probing about carpal tunnel syndrome in our regular checkups with folks?
Anything that causes the tissues to swell, if you think of it that way, will be a comorbidity. So, rheumatoid arthritis, of course, causes inflammation of the tendons and the nerves. So you want to definitely look into that, whether they have a history of a rheumatoid arthritis or they have skin rashes, psoriasis. I saw a patient today with. She just mentioned in passing she had psoriasis, but she's got severe carpal tunnel, and I think it's probably related. So we ordered some blood work to kind of see where she's at with that. So inflammatory disease is a big contributor, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, lupus. And if it's a young person, definitely look into those causes, the swelling in the tissues and the nerves. And you would want to definitely check the thyroid function studies. And then there's other things, of course, to rule out that are not carpal tunnel that can cause numbness in the hands. And of course, that list is quite large. But usually the carpal tunnel history of nighttime symptoms kind of leads you more towards compressive neuropathy or carpal tunnel. Whereas other causes, tumors, cervical problems, cervical neck problems, will be more during the day and activity related.
Okay. And then, if we are, diagnosing this, as you said, based on, the syndrome that they're presenting, the history that's classic, if we're recommending some gentle, glide exercises, maybe a physical therapy or occupational therapy program, or if the patient is more choosing their own program with yoga or something like that, and we see them back in a month or 6 weeks and things have not improved, at what point should we move towards referral to a hand surgeon?
Well, the situation you described is a little bit in the gray zone. You could go another round of treatment if you were comfortable doing steroid injections in the carpal tunnel. I don't know if most, but I get referred a lot of patients at the point you just described. They're not responding to 6 weeks of splinting, anti-inflammatory, stretching, ergonomics. Then they usually will send them to me to try a little bit more treatment. There are some physicians that are doing steroid injections in the carpal tunnel, and if you have experience with that, that would be the next sort of conservative approach. But the two things that really should get the attention of the primary care doctor, in my opinion, to send that patient on is constant numbness. If it's numb, if the fingers are numb all the time, it's never going away. That's a sign that it's progressed to a point where there's really structural issues with the nerve. It's not just an angry nerve, it's becoming fibrotic and constricted. So if they're say, my fingers are numb all the time, I can't hold anything, I'm dropping everything, or they're getting really severe pain radiating up the nerve all the way up into the shoulder. I often tell patients that the median nerve is kind of like a copper wire. If you keep a flame under the end of a copper wire long enough, the whole wire will become hot and angry, and the nerve is the same way. So many patients will come in even and just tell me they have this migrating pain up into their shoulder and neck. And at first you wonder, then maybe it's coming from the neck. But as you ask them more questions, it's carpal tunnel with retrograde symptoms. And of course, the cervical spine can cause the same thing the other way. So this is where it takes a specialist to really get in and ferret that out.
Okay. And would you comment on the utility of and the timing of EMG testing?
EMG nerve conduction studies are kind of the gold standard for most hand surgeons to decide whether they do or do not do the surgery. It's kind of an insurance issue. It acts like a second opinion in a way, and I think it acts as a good check for surgeons. But to be quite honest with you, I already know in my mind 99% of the time I'm correct about whether they're going to need the surgery or not. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but they're very effective. They do give you a degree, an important distinction between minor involvement, moderate, and severe, and that has a lot of implications with respect to surgical outcome.
Would this be something that you would want the primary care physician to have ordered prior to your evaluation, or would you rather be the one to determine the timing of ordering that test?
If you ask my preference, I think I prefer to see the patient and to make that decision myself most of the time. But there are doctors who kind of have who do a lot of carpal tunnel, and they know the system and they come in with the nerve studies. I'm okay with that. I think if you're a primary care doctor who with a very, very intense interest in carpal tunnel and compressive neuropathy, and you treat it a lot and you want to just follow the protocol further out and order the nerve study, I don't have any trouble with it. But what I find is there's many, many things that I find on that first visit that may not have been thought of. And let me give you an example. The second tier of frequency for carpal tunnel is the elderly patient. And now that I'm 60, I'm going to call elderly 80. So it's these older patients, and they come in and they've been told they have carpal tunnel. And I say, well, what is your chief complaint? And the patient looks kind of embarrassed, and they'll say, well, I can't button anything anymore, and I'm falling, and I'm clumsy, and they say that history is not equivalent to carpal tunnel syndrome, as you know. That's mm-hmm. an older person with multifactorial frustration about becoming an older person. You know, there's central issues there. Sometimes mm-hmm. there's some chronic neurologic issues. There's arthritis that's causing their fingers to be stiff. Yes, there might be carpal tunnel as well. They may have a trigger finger. There's usually four or five things contributing to the frustrated patient. And I spend a lot more time with those patients. I don't just get a nerve study and fix their carpal tunnel. I'll spend a lot of time, you know, kind of talking them through it, because if you do carpal tunnel surgery on that patient, they're not going to be particularly thrilled. You know, they won't get worse, but they're not going to get all that dexterity back. And if they expect that, they're going to be disappointed.
You're describing an entity or a syndrome that it seems like a personal awareness of how they keep their body, how they hold their body, and it seems to be different from, say, a procedure like a cardiac coronary artery catheterization, where you just literally remove an obstruction. It seems to me that just the comment that you made is suggestive of a whole lifestyle change that would benefit a person, as opposed to just a simple surgical fix. Am I right that I'm hearing that from you?
You're completely right. This part of my practice is becoming my favorite part of being a hand surgeon. When I moved to Asheville, it was the big trauma and the reattachments of fingers and things and all that. But now that I'm, you know, aging as well, I enjoy in getting involved in these issues with patients. And, you know, a lot of times just they just want someone to acknowledge their frustration. And I'll tell them, I said, you know, that is frustrating. Here's some things you can do. And for me, talking about things like yoga, posture, you know, going to therapy and letting them work with the patient can really help them a lot. And then, you know, the carpal tunnel does help. I don't want to give you the wrong impression, but an 80-year-old patient who has chronic carpal tunnel with arthritis, trigger fingers, maybe some other balance issues, of course, isn't going to get some kind of new hand with a simple surgery.
Right. And then it would be good to hear from you just about the surgery itself and what the timeline looks like, what the procedure is and what the recovery looks like.
You know, carpal tunnel surgery is one of the most frequently performed procedures in the world, really. I looked it up. It's not the top 10. But I think eye surgery, cataract is number one, but it's certainly in the top 20. And it's very common, and the reason it's done frequently is it really does work. There are some people who are very skeptical about that, but if you come in a 30-year-old patient and has carpal tunnel surgery, you're going to get rid of the numbness, and it's going to be successful. So it's a very successful procedure, and it's also quite safe if it's done by a specialist who does it frequently. Outpatient surgery, it's done under local anesthesia, usually with a little bit of sedation. There's different techniques to use, but basically what we're trying to do is to decrease the pressure on the nerve. And if you take and release the transverse carpal ligament, which is the thick ligament across your palm, and also a little bit of the fascia and the distal forearm, the pressure goes from maybe 40 millimeters of mercury down to almost zero the minute you release the ligament. So that's really what we're doing. We're not doing as much to the nerve as I think people think. In fact, most good hand surgeons try not to touch the nerve. You want to release the pressure, and if you have to go in and remove scar tissue, you do it, but it's going to usually mean a little longer recovery for the patient. So that's why it doesn't take a long time to do the procedure in most cases, unless there's some type of unusual finding. There are a lot of variants to the nerves, and that's why it takes a very, careful, qualified surgeon to do it. The two main techniques are open technique or mini open, and then endoscopic. I do the mini open technique because I like to come down on the nerve and see it. I've been trained to do it endoscopically, where you put a scope in and you pull a blade across the carpal tunnel from the inside out. So those are both very accepted and excellent ways to do it. The advantage of the endoscopic has been at least portrayed is less pain and earlier return to work, but the outcome at 3 months is no different. So in my way of reasoning, that I really don't want the patient overdoing it in the first 4 weeks after surgery anyway, because that's what got them into this problem a lot of times. So I don't really see any reason to take possibly take more risk, and I do it with the open technique.
Okay, and then how long are you following folks up for?
Well, they'll have the surgery at the outpatient center, and they'll go home with a little splint on, and they're usually instructed to, keep it clean and dry, and they usually just put a bag over their arm when they shower, and it's really not a big hassle. Obviously, they can't get it wet or dirty, and then at 2 weeks, the stitches will come out, and we give them some simple exercises. Sometimes a therapist is involved. Most of the time, it's just simple thing that I tell them to do. And their palm will be tender for about 4 to 6 weeks, sometimes a little bit longer. As far as the nerve waking up, that is completely dependent on a lot of factors. The age of the patient, probably number one, how chronic the problem is, and then again, how small, the smaller incisions do better. So we try to keep the incisions small.
Okay. And what kind of numbers do you see as far as effectiveness? I don't know when the proper time to measure that is. Is it 6 weeks? Is it 6 months? Is it 1 year?
Yeah, the studies are all over the place with this. I mean, if you look at overall patient satisfaction, it's in the 98% range at 1 year, certainly. If you dissect it in more detail, like the 85-year-old patient that I was mentioning earlier, I'll bring that patient back up again. They're going to tell you, if you do a questionnaire, well, are you still clumsy? Yes. It's not going to fix those things. So as long as the patient knows ahead of time what the expectation is, which is to improve sensation, then most of them will be very happy with it. But for an older patient who's got severe carpal tunnel, it can take a whole year to see maximum improvement.
Okay. Well, I certainly have learned a whole lot from you just up to this point. I think one of the particular questions that our audience with this ACO has is what about this whole process do you think could be adjusted, whether it be from the primary care end or the specialist end or the therapist end, to make things more cost effective, more efficient for the patient, and just in generally, you know, improving health outcomes for the patient?
That's a really good question, and I'm kind of surprised at the answer I'm coming up with, but I think more of a focus on lifestyle, which I know you're doing anyway, so, but maybe specifically add in the effect it has on the musculoskeletal system, particularly the carpal tunnel and the hands. So when the patients are young and they're not, they're sitting there all slumped over and they've got very poor posture and depressed and maybe getting overweight and living unhealthy, that patient, I can just see them with their carpal tunnel 10 years down the road. So, I mean, that whole push to get that patient to get a strong, you know, body core, whether it's through some exercise or whatever, and ergonomic adjustments to their work, and even work satisfaction, all that feeds in. So I know that's not very specific, but I think that's one area that I'm working on with my patients, and I think that continued work with at the primary care level will keep a lot of patients from having to have surgery. And again, not to use myself too much as an example, but I've had, my fingers are a little tingly right now, actually, because I just paddle boarded, but my, I've had carpal tunnel. At one time, they were really densely numb after I had done some long exercising, and I've avoided surgery through doing a lot of the things we talked about, which is working on my posture, working on my core, you know, obviously trying to live healthy and fit. So I think it really will cut down on the number of surgeries doing all that. As far as the mechanics of referral, I'm pretty happy with the way this community is doing it. I get very appropriate referrals, and you know, your question about whether the nerve study should be done, you know, before they see me or not is a good one, but I hope I answered that by saying that the complexity of issues, particularly in the elderly population, I think you're better to let us order those in that population. If you do have a classic patient who's 35 and you've tried, you know, 2 months of splinting and stretching and nothing's working, it's totally appropriate to get the nerve study. And that might save one, you know, visit with the hand surgeon.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing your expertise, and I want to give you an opportunity for the last word or any real bullet points you want to hit home.
Bullet points I want to hit home. First of all, you know, don't listen to the patients who are might hear this, but you know, the word on the street isn't the place to get the answer of how well people do with carpal tunnel. Because you have to know specifically what you're doing, what you're trying to accomplish with carpal tunnel syndrome, and that's to get rid of the numbness in the fingers and the pain up the arm. It doesn't do, you know, a lot of things people want it to do. It doesn't make their hand younger and things like that. And so that would be number one. And then I think we've already hit this many times about just staying healthy, because it's much more difficult to get someone's wound to heal when they're a smoker, they're overweight, diabetic, or whatever. So that is a huge factor and just makes the surgical healing much better. So those are the two big things. And then it is a multifactorial, input approach. The therapists are very helpful. And even with ergonomics and designing tools and how to do, you know, a patient who maybe is having trouble with a golf club, you can increase the diameter of the golf club and things like that. So those are the things I would focus most on.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. Have a good one.